the Queensland Country Hour with Ali Felton-Taylor on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Coming up, difficult milk price negotiations with tropical dairy farmers in the north are saying the process has delivered no substantive change in the farm gate price. Also, you'll hear about the future of mining communities. What is it in 2021, especially in a transition to renewables? You'll get a special report from the northern part of the Bowen Basin with views from Collinsville's Pit Pony Tavern, among the many we've canvassed. And we're going to take you back to Rocky, where you guessed it, we're talking beef, but this time at the annual show, where we had some kids telling us like it is.
What do you think made your animals winners?
Just the judge.
Out of the mouths of babes, you'll hear more on the future of the beef industry closer to one. But first today, the majority of peanuts eaten in Australia are imported from overseas. Climate change and unreliable seasons is causing production to plummet in traditional growing areas like Kingaroy in Queensland, the historic peanut capital. The industry is now looking to expand in other places, including the arid red centre of Australia, to try and grow domestic production. John Daly has this story.
It's a pantry staple for millions of Australians, but the majority of peanuts that end up on toast are from overseas. About 70% of the nuts that roll through Bega Foods' massive processing facility in the Queensland town of Kingaroy are foreign. That's something General Manager Adam McNamara wants to change.
Demand is outstripping supply. So the Australian peanut market is about 45,000 tonnes. And in more recent years, about 70% of that is imported. So our ambition as a Great Australian Food Company is to really increase the level of Australian peanuts and become less reliant on imported peanuts.
There's one big challenge with that. Climate change is causing big shifts to rainfall in the Burnett region, the industry's most important dryland growing area. University of Southern Queensland climatologist Chelsea Jarvis says the South Burnett region, where the industry's first peanuts were planted in the early 1900s, is particularly feeling the pain.
The trend for the amount of rain in the South Burnett region is unfortunately declining, as it has been since about 1920 overall. And we've seen declines of about a millimetre and a half to 2 millimetres per year, which doesn't sound like a lot, but over decades it actually has added up to quite a lot, as I think people have probably started noticing now. And look, just because there's a trend towards less rainfall doesn't mean that you won't still get heavy rainfall and floods in certain years, but it means overall that rainfall has become less reliable than it used to be.
So they're the snack food peanuts, those fellas?
Someone seeing that firsthand is second generation peanut grower Wayne Weller, who farms north of Kingaroy.
Well, John, last year is the first year in 50 years that we haven't planted peanuts on this farm. Well, we're finding we're getting instead of getting regular rainfalls, we're getting large amounts of rain and then large gaps between the rain events. We're getting about the same average rainfall in the year, but the pattern of getting the rain has changed.
Right, so the timing of it is changing.
Yes, definitely, definitely.
And how does that impact you and your business?
Well, we like to plant peanuts the first week in November, and then we like to see a good rain about 12 weeks after that for what we call a setting crop. And then another 8 to 10 weeks of good, steady, warm, moist weather from there on out to finish the crop off. We've been finding we've been getting reasonable planting rain and no rain in January, February, which is the prime months.
Do you think this is, you know, the new normal, or what's your take on what's behind this?
Well, I think it could be cyclical, John. I think, we've only been here a couple of hundred years, white man, and we don't know what the weather patterns have been in the past. But we're thinking that it could be the norm, so we're just going to have to adjust our management.
Breeding drought-tolerant varieties for the future is one way the industry is adapting. The other way is growing peanuts in other places altogether.
No doubt it's a challenge, that volatility, and that's why the diversification of our growing regions is so key. There's access to water in other parts of Australia where we believe we can grow peanuts as well. So therefore, diversifying the growing regions is really critical for us to have the ability to grow the Australian peanut crop.
Central Australia is one of the industry's newest production areas.
I could say they call me the nutty melon farmer now. They used to call me the watermelon man, now they call me the nutty melon farmer.
Paul McLaughlin has been growing peanuts in rotation with watermelons on his farm at Alicarung, a few hours north from Alice Springs.
We get a lot of surprises when people learn that we're growing peanuts out here because they associate peanuts with Queensland and Kingaroy. So, yeah, a lot of people surprised. But people were surprised when we came here 13 years ago growing watermelons too, and that's been very successful. So I think the peanuts, once we've got the growing worked out, it'll be another success story for Central Australia.
Crops here are grown under irrigation and sustained by vast underground aquifers. And under that baking red centre sun, peanuts actually do pretty well.
It's very similar climate to Texas, West Texas, that has very similar soil and similar climate to here. And they grow, I think it's a couple million tonnes of peanuts in West Texas. So yeah, this climate is ideal for peanuts.
The biggest challenge out here is the tyranny of distance, and Paul is building his own shelling facility to reduce freight costs to Queensland. Back in Kingaroy, farmers are feeling the crunch of a changing climate, but they're determined to find a local solution.
I think with the competition from other crops that are more reliable, I think that it's in decline. The short-term answer, I think, around here is irrigation, if we want to continue to grow peanuts in the South Burnett. But that becomes expensive with the added costs. But I think the long-term is plant breeding. Breed varieties that can cope with the changing conditions. The bottom line is we've got to get on with it. Whatever the cause is, if we want to continue to grow peanuts, we'll have to adapt.
That's Kingaroy peanut farmer Wayne Weller finishing that piece from Toowoomba reporter John Daly. It'll be on the telly this Sunday on Landline, ABC TV 12:30, or you can stream it on ABC iView. Well, renewable energy is the future, but Queensland banks on the traditional mining sector for its profits. So what does the transition out of fossil fuels look like for people in those mining communities? You'll head to the Bowen Basin soon, but the disappointing price negotiations for tropical dairy farmers on their milk price coming up 12 past 12.
The Queensland Country Hour with Ali Felton-Taylor on ABC Radio Queensland.
Far North Queensland dairy farmers say they've been dealt another blow with the latest round of milk price negotiations, delivering no substantive change at the farm gate. Many in the Dairy Farmers Milk Collective, or DFMC, believed when the wholly owned Bega Cheese took control of the Malanda Milk Factory, it might break a long-standing impasse between farmers and the processing sector. However, it was not to be. Negotiations concluded last week, and just like its Japanese predecessor, Bega refused to budge on price. Queensland Dairy Farmers State Councillor James Geraghty has told Charlie McKillop, while it puts pressure on the future of dairying in the far north, he's still convinced farmers are better off with Bega.
We have got some raises in some other areas because of the competitive nature of each region. We're not leading the pack, but we're in the pack, and not far from the front in a lot of places. I think Bega's struggling a little bit, Charlie, because they don't know this region. And yeah, I mean, we've just got to give them time to learn about here and learn about the differences between here and everywhere else that milks cows. I don't think a lot of farmers are very happy with the outcome. There's farmers who, yeah, there's people starting to question why they're here. It's very tight financially. They were expecting a price rise, and they're starting to question their longevity in the industry.
Why has there been so little communication on that work this time round? There were no meetings in advance of the negotiations, no communication since the outcome was known.
Righto, so we tried to have meetings up here in the last week of May. Those dates became conflicted and couldn't happen. And we actually want to meet here with Bega with us. This is a partnership between Bega and DFMC. All the farms that supply the Malanda factory are DFMC suppliers. All the milk that's processed at Malanda comes from DFMC. The optics of it would be terrible if we were here because we thought we should be here and we needed to talk to farmers. And then the COVID restrictions and travel restrictions allowed Bega to be here 2 weeks later. The optics, while there would be no issue, the optics of that would be terrible.
But beyond the optics, don't dairy farmers deserve an explanation? I mean, the deal's been done for more than a week.
Yep, absolutely. absolutely agree with that, but we're trying to get Bega up here to discuss the outcome with the farmers as soon as possible.
Is the status quo enough for dairy farmers who had looked to Bega with a sense of anticipation that maybe finally there'd be some change to attitude when it came to this long-standing unwillingness of the processor to give anything?
Righto. Are farmers going to hang around and wait? No. No, they're not. Those that have made their decisions, I can only remember one of my farmers getting out of dairying quickly. He was frustrated as all hell with it. He talked to a bloke on Sunday. He sold his cows on Wednesday and finished on Wednesday afternoon. He's the only one that went quick. Most times it takes a couple of years of planning and discussion and working it out. It's rarely a knee-jerk reaction. But saying that, you know, I've got a couple of farmers that have got plans in place, and if the price jumped 10 cents today, it wouldn't really make that much difference to them. They'd go because they've already got the plans in place. To the rest of us, I just think I'm really disappointed that Bega couldn't get up here earlier in the year. You have to remember, they've only been there like 4 months, eh? They're still trying to get their minds around what they've bought and how they're going to utilise some of that. And it does come down to a trade-off between Bega having time to organise, to plan, to implement those plans, and farmers sitting out on the farm under huge financial stress in a lot of cases, trying to decide where they're going to go. And that's the trade-off that has been there for a few years, and it will continue to be there for a while. But the belief is that Bega will rectify this situation. We're probably looking at a minimum of 12 months, Charlie, until they get their minds around what they've bought and where it is and how to go forward.
Does the fact that Bega was unable to come up with an increase in the milk price, does that vindicate Lyons' long-held position that there wasn't any room to move and that any price rise wouldn't ultimately be sustainable?
Look, all the processors have historically said and continue to say that where they sell white milk, they are losing money, which to me begs the question, Charlie, like Queensland now produces some 200-plus million litres of milk less than we consume. Yet we continue to have generic discounted milk on the shelves of every supermarket. How come? Yet, you know, the white milk processors, the ones that sell white milk, Lactalis and Bega, Saputo in some regions, they continue to lose money, and yet Coles is in the market paying like 10 cents a litre more. They are the highest payers to the farmer and the lowest price on the shelf.
Well, Bega must have felt that there was some value in white milk. They snapped up the Melanda factory and Lion Dairy and Drinks for, what was it, nearly $500 million?
Yep. In the next 12 to 18 months, 2 years, I think you'll start to see, like, you look at Bega with Vegemite and peanut butter. They absolutely turned those brands around. They're not backward in marketing. They push the brand. The peanut growers up here are very, very happy with dealing with Bega. And we're looking for that same relationship with Bega.
That's QDO representative for Far North Queensland and a member of the Dairy Farmers Milk Collective, or the DFMC, James Geraghty, speaking there with our Cairns reporter, Charlie McKillop. Well, next, I'm going to take you to one of the earliest mining areas in this state, part of the Bowen Basin. It's 18 past 12.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
The future of the Queensland resources sector is often up for debate, but what do mining communities see as the way forward? The state government has launched a resources industry development plan to engage resource communities and workers on their future as they face both challenges and new opportunities. Tom Major visited Collinsville this week, and he asked locals like publican Janet Lobergeier for their take.
Look, anything they do for the mining industry is great for us. You know, whether you like it or don't like it, mining industry is around, and mining industry is what keeps this little town going, and it's what this town is built on. So if we could encourage more young people to go into the mining industry, whether it's with incentives of wages or so forth, we need to keep coal mining going. We would also like to see a coal-fired power station here in town, and there's often talk of that, and why would you not build one right alongside a coal mine? So fingers crossed that one day we might see that happen in the town as well.
That was Pit Pony Tavern publican Collinsville's Janet Lobergeier. And while there's renewed interest in new market minerals, particularly those used in renewable energy and battery manufacture, there's signs mineral exploration expenditure is growing significantly, with ABS data showing it's up 22.5% to $705 million in the state of Queensland over the last 12 months. And while 14.5% of that is down to mineral searches, oil and gas exploration is up 53.1% on previous figures, showing strength in some of those traditional energy sources and interest in their exploitation. Mike Brunker is a man with deep roots in the town of Collinsville. He's a former coal mine worker and mayor of Bowen and has spent 23 years in local politics. Councillor Brunker says adding to Collinsville's mix of employment will be critical to the town's future.
Well, it'd be interesting to see if there's other jobs bar the coal or whether there's new reserves. They'll be looking at infrastructure and how that can pertain to Collinsville. So water is a key out there, so for any industry, whether we might even be looking at gold, whether gold could be a resurgence out there as well, because it comes and goes in the Mount Coolin area. So and obviously the Carmichael Basin is out there, and further down there's other resources as well. So we'd have to be looking at rail as well, so major rail networks as far as maintenance and facilities, if any more mines are to start up.
Is there enough incentive out there for prospecting and for minerals to be developed in the Collinsville and North Bowen area?
Well, usually you'll find once a mineral or a resource rises in value, that's where your smaller mining companies will come in and do the research and of course, the looking for new deposits and leases. So there is significant coal mining leases still out there, and of course gold in the Mount Coolin area. So fingers crossed, you never know what's going to happen.
Collinsville and its two mines, you know, they really do contribute quite a significant amount of royalties to the Queensland government. Do you believe the local community there is getting that back in terms of planning for the times when the coal price dips, the mines shut down, or there is a fundamental change in the marketplace?
Well, no, they don't, and I think you'll get that from all mining resources. So if you drive around the Bowen Basin and drive around Moranbah and Dysart and those sorts of areas, the road network out there is terrible. It's bloody terrible. So a lot more investment, whether it's health, whether it's roads, needs to happen in that particular area. And, of course, that's where the money comes from. So the Lady Salendo Hospital, Suncorp Stadium, all of those big projects, the Cross River Rail, comes from mining resources, comes from royalties. So it's produced in the regions, and sometimes a lot of it's spent in the south.
Mike Brunker with Sunday Shire Councillor. Steve Borrellini is a coastal-based contractor at the Sonoma Coal Mine, one of the town of Collinsville's two main mines. And as a former mine worker himself, he says he left mining towns for a number of reasons, but still thinks coal mining will remain a major part of these economies in central and north Queensland for many years to come.
I didn't mind the work, and I work with a good bunch of fellas, and yeah, I don't mind it. So you come and go and do your work, and like I said, I don't mind it.
Looking back on your time in the industry, and also, I guess, with a view to the future, what sort of things do you think will keep towns like Collinsville going and keep them alive as, I guess, the resources world changes?
Good question. Yeah, way above my pay grade, but yeah, coal's going to be around for a little bit more, I'd say, but yeah, everyone's looking at greener things and better things, I suppose, we hope, for the future. But yeah, look, we'll keep going for a bit, as long as we've got something for the grandkids, that's the main thing.
That's Steve Borrellini ending that report from Tom Major. You can have your say on the development strategy and what its aims should be. Just head to the Queensland Department of Resources website, click through the link. So head to the Queensland Resources website and have your say. Now, next, we're going to hear from a younger generation on drought. At the National Drought Forum held in Toowoomba earlier this week, it's 25 past 12.
The Queensland Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Now, often when drought is discussed, it's from the perspective of a farmer of a certain age, those who have been on the land for generations. But what about ideas from younger people in agriculture? This week's National Drought Forum saw UNICEF youth representatives Sally Downey and Monique Worsley, both from rural New South Wales, as part of the conversation. The ABC's Lucy Cooper spoke to Monique Worsley first of all and asked her what's missing in drought policy from the perspective of young people.
I think there's a lot of specialised support services that are missing, particularly for rural and regional students in terms of mental health support services, whether that's at home or in transition to university. It's quite hard to access a specialised service with somebody who understands kind of where you're coming from. You get a psychologist from Sydney who's got no idea what's going on, and it's sort of, there's no point really even talking to them at all. As well as that, I think transitional support services are really, really important. You've got programs like Country to Canberra and rural and regional student support services at universities, but there's just not enough government work happening in that sort of field. It's kind of left to individuals to put together, and you just don't have the funding or the backing behind it.
And you both expressed that feeling of hopelessness in your speeches when it comes to helping those affected by drought. Have young people been forgotten by the agricultural policy in Australia?
I think in a way, yes, we have. I think a lot of the media representation, whether it was someone announcing support or if it was someone sharing their experience of drought, it always come from an older generation. They definitely have their place, but so does youth, because we're the future farmers and the future industry leaders, and we need a voice at the table because we're the ones that will take on that industry.
Monique, you do have that unique experience where you have grown up rurally and you now study in a city. Would you say there's a gap between those who live in urban areas and those who live regionally?
I think absolutely there is. You know, the 99.95 ATAR you get at one of those Sydney schools means nothing if you think wool grows on trees. These kids just really don't have much of an idea of actually what's going on behind the scenes, who's putting the food on their table, who's putting the clothes on their back. They kind of have this real disconnect and just lack of understanding, which really makes rural kids, when they go to university, feel quite isolated. It's extremely disheartening when, you know, you're working your butt off when it's a drought or when it's a good season, and then the people who are profiting from it, just they don't even thank a farmer for their next meal.
Is that disconnect then evident in when there was the national call out for on-farm workers across Australia during this COVID pandemic? Not many young people seem to answer that call. Is that an expression of that disconnect?
I think absolutely it is. You know, it was a great opportunity for so many people to actually get out and work on a farm and actually really make a difference and help out. And I think, yeah, the lack of people answering the call definitely just shows a lack of interest and also just that kind of lack of grit. Whereas rural kids, you know, time and time again, we show up, we answer the call. These city kids, they fail to show up.
And Sally, it's evident that there is not sufficient services available to rural and regional populations, especially in drought-affected areas across Australia. You have taken initiative to make a difference, but what needs to happen for systemic change?
I think our support services, firstly, we need to really realise the issue, but we need to realise that implementing something that works in the city into a regional community is not going to work. When we start talking about this telehealth for mental health, it's not going to work if you can't have reliable internet. It's also not the same as going to someone face-to-face and them actually seeing you. And country people have a thing of trying to hide what's wrong and putting on a brave face. And I think it requires face-to-face services for people to be able to see through that. There's also a level of government to kind of step up and fund that and be able to willing to like step away from what works in the city and realise there's two different areas.
Well, there's some views right there. That's UNICEF Youth Representative Sally Downey. And you also heard from Monique Worsley. That was at the National Drought Forum earlier this week in Toowoomba. Thanks very much to the ABC's Lucy Cooper for heading along and garnering those views. Coming up on the Country Hour, you're off to the Richmond Field Days after the weather. Things get a bit technical up there. Virtual and augmented reality is the order of the day. And we're going to drill into the ag machinery boom and just what pressure has been put on Australian manufacturers. It's always a tough situation when a farmer wants an implement yesterday and the wait time is months, not weeks. That's all out at Farm Fest, which ended this week. Anthea Moody, you were there yesterday, but now you've got the latest rural news for us. What's going on?
Well, public hearings into the future of reef regulations in Queensland are underway in Brisbane. Conservationists, farming groups, government departments and tourism operators are set to give evidence on the reversal of the Great Barrier Reef Protection Measures Bill. If passed, the bill introduced by Katter's Australian Party would establish an independent office to oversee regulation, reduce the number of reef catchments from 6 to 3, and reverse regulation and penalties units to 2009 levels. The differences in food and agriculture standards between the United Kingdom and Australia are emerging as issues of concern in the coming free trade deal. British farmers, environmentalists and consumers fear that imports from Australia will compromise the UK's high animal welfare and food standards. The differences range from the use of hormones to pesticides and, more recently, regulations around farming methods that address climate change. And finally, a worker has died at the Mount Monger gold operations in Western Australia's goldfields, the third death at an underground mine in Western Australia in the past year. The mine owners, ASX-listed Silver Lake Resources, issued a statement that a contractor died in an incident at the underground mining complex this morning. Mining has been suspended at the Department of Mines Industry Regulation, and safety has sent inspectors to the site. More news at one.
Thanks very much, Anthea Moody. You have a lovely weekend. Let's check on the latest weather. You're all rugged up, I have to say. Here I am too. Looking out the window, it is a beautiful, bright day. Blue skies, but there were some wild-looking clouds here in the southern part of the state. And I think the word to describe everything, while ever we flag this cold snap, is that it's crisp. It's crisp. It's chilly. Phelim Hanafee, would you agree?
I would indeed, yeah. Noticeably crisp this morning across parts, particularly about parts of the southeast, right up into central parts of the state as well. Further south, a bit of cloud cover kind of kept things a little bit on the milder side as well. But for tonight now, another cool and crisp night ahead as well. Probably a little bit cooler as well, given that less cloud around. There may be some still lingering about the far southern areas, so about the Granite Belt and southern Darling Downs. So may just keep temps slightly a little bit up above the zero mark here, but elsewhere looking at quite a chilly, another noticeably chilly Saturday morning to come as well. Over the next few days though, the temperatures are going to be on the upward trend anyway. We're looking at warmer days, still some cool mornings though, particularly about the southern and southeastern tier, but we are looking at milder weather coming as we go through the weekend and early next week. Generally, temperatures a lot warmer as well, and a bit more unsettled as well. We'll have a trough kind of slowly deepening through the inland parts as we go through the weekend, up over the northeast tropics, just inland, and then extending in towards the central inland, and eventually into the southern tier early next week. Bring a bit milder weather, a bit more moisture, and the chance of a shower or even thunderstorm through the early days of next week. And that's all ahead of another potential cold front that's going to really just combine with that system and sweep eastwards through the middle of next week. So another round of showers and even potentially some rain as well to come through the middle of next week, particularly about central and southern areas.
So that new trough coming through and a cold front mixed into that. We'll get to that in 2 seconds, because before I leave this cold weather, I love a gold, silver and bronze scenario. I'm just toggling down. I think between us we're going to be able to work it out. Was Billa Wheeler at -0.7 the lowest in the state? Did it take out the... Hold on, let me go down further. Is that right, the low temperature? Was it the winner?
Let's see.
Because Blackall was in negative territory too. Blackall had -0.3, but Billa Wheeler, -0.7. They were the two coldest spots in the state.
There was indeed, yeah. It was. A bit of cloud cover helped prevent further south being too cold. So, yeah, right through that central areas and up into parts of the west as well was the coolest overnight. And tonight again, it's probably going to be them areas again that'll see some of the cooler temps once again.
Although I must say, it's gone past 9 a.m. so that Stanthorpe doesn't appear to have a low temp at that. So it could well have surpassed that -0.7. Do you have any intel on that, Phelim? I'm asking you too
Stanthorpe
many questions.
Yeah, it was a little bit milder actually down towards Stanthorpe, given that we had quite a bit of cloud cover across the area overnight. So actually the coolest and driest here was a little bit further north, was kind of through that central parts of the state.
Well, there we go. Below, you've won the gold medal. I don't know if it's something you want to win, the coldest part of Queensland. And as you say, that cloud keeping things snugly warm, well, warmer. We couldn't call it snugly warm, but definitely warmer down on the Granite Belt in that area. Let's jump to this forecast rainfall that you've been talking about. I've toggled to Tuesday on the Bureau's site in terms of forecast rainfall, and it's quite a bit up and down the coast, that usual area sort of in between Cairns and Townsville, but then it extends inland in those central parts. It's pretty unstable, isn't it, at the moment, the forecast between 1 and 10 millimetres at best. But could it turn out to be more?
Yeah, potentially. A lot will hinge on how much that trough, as it deepens, how much moisture gets sucked into it and then gets brought down. The air mass is very dry at the moment to the interior, but over the next few days, that trough is going to just slowly develop and then deepen early next week. So a lot of the rain, particularly when the cold front taps into it, it'll depend on how much moisture that trough has built up first before we get the next system kind of rolling in, tapping into it. And it could bring some decent thunderstorm activity with it as well. So it's probably one to keep an eye on when you get that kind of building moisture combining with a colder air mass coming in, recipe for some significant storm activity as well through that, particularly towards the middle of next week. So one to keep an eye on.
Don't worry. There's one thing that you can be sure of with a forecast is that farmers will be keeping an eye on it. No doubt you know well. Phelim Hanafy, thank you so much for that. There are no warnings. That sheep grazier's warning cancelled. And otherwise, a quick look at coastal waters. Anything of note?
No, it's pretty quiet. We're really up north. You have a bit of a brisk southeast wind up north, but no warnings at this stage. It's probably not till, it looks like when we get the next change, which is after the middle of next week, you'll see a bit stronger wind flows returning, particularly up over the northern waters.
Phelim Hanafy, thank you so much. Have a lovely weekend.
You too.
Cheerio.
The Queensland Country Hour with Ali Felton-Taylor on ABC Radio Queensland.
Let me take you to the northwest. Tractors, cars, even helicopters have been making their way to Richmond this week for the annual field days, which began this morning. The event cancelled last week, of course, because of COVID. But this year it's back. Our reporter Eric Barker is at the field days. Eric, have you warmed up yet?
Yeah, g'day Ali. It's a beautiful afternoon here at the Richmond Field Days. It started as a pretty cold day, but it has warmed up quite a bit. There's a few clouds in the sky, but it's mostly sunny, and they've all turned out. A lot of exhibitors here. I'm looking at some big graders and tractors right in front of me at the moment. There's some tanks in the background. Some of the banks have some quite big displays, so there's no doubt going to be some wheeling and dealing going on here, at least some networking at the Richmond Field Days. The organisers of the Field Days have decided to really look into ag tech, which is a developing side of the agricultural industry. They've got a dedicated little section there, and Tim Gentle is probably the poster of that ag tech section. He does a lot of work using virtual and augmented reality, and I caught up with Tim early this morning and had a go at his goggles.
Well, one of the things we want to do is showcase the ag tech in the area. And so instead of travelling out to the cattle yards, I took out my 360 camera and I captured some of the auto weighing and drafting facilities. The whole idea is I capture it, you guys come to the field day, you put on a headset and beams you out to the property.
Now, it's a bit of a different one at the moment. I'm actually standing underneath the shed here at the Richmond Field Days with a pair of augmented reality goggles on. It, right above my broadcasting kit that I'm using, I can see a lamb carcass, which is, well, it's just sort of suspended in air. It's not quite strung up to the roof. And then to the right, there's a Droughtmaster bull. Now, I did put this, I did put these goggles on before the program, and the bull was in a different spot, so he is kind of moving around behind me. The tail's wagging. Tim Gentle, how's all of this happening?
Well, the great news is, Eric, you've got a pair of augmented reality glasses on. And the reason is, you can see me, right?
I can, yeah.
How many fingers am I holding up?
You're holding up four.
Correct, right? But you can also see a lamb carcass and a Droughtmaster bull. So augmented reality blends the real world and the digital world together. So I've put the carcass on the table. How good would that be for someone training in an abattoir to learn about where to bone the carcass? And the Droughtmaster bull, how good would it be if you were learning about animal health and going and doing some health checks? So we're using AR wearables for training and education.
And he does look very realistic, the Droughtmaster bull. It's maybe not quite as high definition as the ones that are over penned up in the yards that you'll be hearing about in a couple of minutes' time. But you've actually been out at the walkover weighing facilities, which is kind of where cattle are automatically weighing themselves each day to give a bit more data with things like the amount of weight they gain in a day. How could this technology that you've been using help with displaying that data?
Well, think about these cattle tags that we're seeing popping up now, the smart tags, right? So they hold data, the number of the cow, maybe the last weighing, if they're in calf, could be the prodigy. So imagine looking at a cow and then overlaying the data on the cow as it goes past you. So think a bit like Iron Man, where he Richard Stark, whatever his name is, he looks through his glasses and he sees all this digital matter. So augmented reality glasses, though, Eric, the serious side of is that they actually allow you to have two hands again. Because if you're holding up a phone and you're trying to read the data, well, where's the other hand going? You know, you've got to hold it. The AR glasses allow you to have two hands again.
Well, Transformers is probably the last thing you think when you do see a paddock full of cows. And so it would be looking, you'd be looking at things like the amount of weight they would gain in a day. That sort of information, do you think that would be quite helpful?
Well, also, you could be looking at a tank and you could be seeing how full it is. You could be looking at a soil probe and understanding what the information is about the soil. You could be looking at a weather station and it would give you the reading. You could even look over the paddock and actually look at the feed on hand and the NDVI data. So think of it like your real world becomes a blend of digital and real things. And that allows us to become more productive because we're not reaching into our pocket to pick out a phone. We're not looking at our phone and looking down. We're looking up and around the environment. And by the way, Eric, you look really cool in those glasses, by the way.
Oh, well, I feel really cool because there was somebody that just came up and gave me a wave. They stood awfully close to this bull that's standing awfully close to me. So Tim has put his virtual reality goggles on. So Tim, you can't see me at the moment, can you?
I'm not actually at Richmond at the moment. I'm in a virtual world.
Does it have a cup of coffee in it?
Well, it's a lot warmer in here, I can tell you. Actually, I'm standing in a yard. I'm surrounded by four or five drought masters, and I'm about to move them up to the back bay. And so doing some virtual reality means I can't see the real world.
Tim Gentle, he's from a company called Think Digital, and he mainly works with virtual and augmented reality goggles. Had a bit of a go at the augmented reality. I didn't have a go at the virtual reality because that means I wouldn't be able to see what was going on in front of me, which is a bit hard while you're producing some radio. Another big ticket event here at the Richmond Field Days is the bull sale. It's not a big bull sale by any means, but it always attracts plenty of support from the locals. Cody Rogers and Ashley Nicolario are from the Richmond Combined Agents, and I caught up with them yesterday afternoon. Cody says that this year's bull sale is still being impacted by the 2019 floods.
We started off with a good first round of nominations, and from that we've been able to draw 23 bulls from mainly across local areas. We've got one that's come up from New South Wales, a bit of a special invitation from him, but some really good quality local bulls have come around from Huendon and Richmond areas.
So who's come up from New South Wales?
Rod Binnick. So he's got some Charolais bulls coming up. He's got some very good young bulls, and he's looking to showcase his Charolais bulls up here in the north. Rod was actually bringing some bulls up that he'd sold, so he's already sort of heading this direction and reached out to us to see if he could put some bulls in the sale, which is certainly more than welcome, and happy to have him along.
So you mentioned 23 bulls, was it, Cody? How's that compare to your normal year here at the Richmond Field Days?
It's probably a bit down on numbers. That's a fair thing because these are our number 9 bulls we're selling now. So, going back 2 years, of course, we had the floods up here. So a lot of these calves were born sort of in and around that time, putting everyone sort of had lower calving numbers that year. But, yeah, so out of the 23 bulls, there's 6 or 7 vendors, I think, 7 vendors this year. So, no, it's pretty good, really.
And have you both noticed that in your general work, that the impact of the floods coming through this year?
Oh, certainly we're seeing it on the Downs country. It hasn't really recovered that well. Our perennial feed hasn't really responded well at all. We've had some herbage and an annual grass has come up, so the Downs has done it a bit tough. Our breeded country's holding on very well. It's had a better than average season across the north, so our breeding country's looking very good, and obviously that's where we're going to draw the support for most of this sale, so that's looking good.
What about for you, Cody?
It's probably the same. So I'm based more over Huendon, and North of Huendon's experienced a very good year this year. Thus far, it's probably better than Richmond. The Downs is a better patch of Downs country over there. I know I haven't been back for a little bit, but last night we got a bit cold down to 1 or whatever it was. So there's probably a bit of frost north of Huendon there. Might restrict a little bit. But apart from that, yeah, I think it's shaping up to be a fairly good year. With support from that breeding area is going to only help this sale.
How have you been going in terms of your work at the start of this year? I've been having a bit of a look at the Auctions Plus results, and I've noticed plenty of Northwest Queensland agents kind of topping the numbers, the weekly numbers that they've been putting up. Have you had quite a busy year, Ashley?
Yeah, look, it's been a very busy year. Combination of things, I suppose, but the price is certainly helping people. It's not a very tough decision to put cattle up for sale at the moment. So, I mean, we've been using Auctions Plus, obviously, a fair bit, as everyone has in the north. Been a lot of support and a lot of cattle going into New South Wales off that platform, so that's been good. But generally speaking, it's been a very busy year for all agents in the northwest. There's a lot of cattle left the area. Generally prices and just reasonable grass conditions, I guess. So everyone's taken a bit of an opportunity to take the money while it's there and conserve what grass they've got for some weaners coming around second round.
Ashley Nicolario, he's from the Richmond Combined Agents, preparing for the bull sale, which is set to wrap up in the middle of the afternoon. But there is plenty going on in northwest Queensland. I'm heading over to Cloncurry this afternoon for the show there, where there is no doubt going to be plenty of cattle action happening in the Curry as well. So never bored here in northwest Queensland, Ali.
There's no way you could be bored, Eric Barker. Thanks very much to you for that report from the Richmond Field Days. Safe travels to Cloncurry. No doubt the Cloncurry show president Drew Haken has pinned his ear back, as well as his committee. Of course, they'll be working hard. That'll be a great couple of days. Now though, let's dig into the story of demand for agricultural machinery. It continues to sit at record high levels across Australia, and with good seasonal conditions and the federal government's asset write-off contributing, the run on tractors has seen a huge jump in sales, and that's flowed on to big demand for farm implements and equipment, meaning some big challenges for manufacturers in this country. The rush to buy was evident at Australia's third largest ag and machinery field days on Queensland's Darling Downs, where the ABC's Anthea Moody discovered the immense pressure that comes with this type of boom.
Farmfest, just west of Toowoomba, often heralds the start of chilly weather for the region. But this week's cold snap did nothing to curb the flow through the gates of the three-day event. Whether people were just there for a look or genuine customers, exhibitors all agreed that demand was high, and while the wait time for Australian-manufactured machinery is generally shorter, the delays in getting parts from overseas is still slowing the process. Toowoomba-based manufacturer TTQ Holdings has pointed to the increased price of materials and labour shortages, both proving difficult to manage. TTQ Director G Hudson says it's the highest demand he's ever seen, and it may lead to a stop-dead day.
There are components that are becoming increasingly difficult to get. The supply chains are all longer, and the pricing's getting a little bit squeezed. People talk about steel prices, particularly in the machinery we sort of make. You know, there's a lot of steel in it. Steel hasn't been hard to get, it's just been more expensive. But things like wheels and tyres and cylinders and things like that are actually difficult to get. Gearboxes for our mulchers, we've been told to be a 10-month wait list now, so we'd miss next cotton season for anything we haven't already bought.
What are some of the rough estimated wait times on some of the machinery that you've got?
We're keeping up at the moment, so to speak. We got a late October delivery time now if you ordered today, and that's not bad. One of our other challenges, though, for homegrown, you know, homemade machinery is we're actually staff deficient. We don't have enough welders or assembly teams, so we're working with a smaller crew than we'd like to work. So that's a bigger constraint than the materials and the components.
I mean, wait time till October, really, as you said, is not that bad. Do you think this wait time will stop people from purchasing?
No, I think we're okay at the moment. But we've done, recently we started sort of talking about cotton 2022. So we make a range of machinery specifically for cotton industry. And a couple of the machines we make are the only ones of their type. So there's a bit of demand there for that. We have never really got orders before November for the following year before. But we've probably sold 10 machines for 2022 delivery already. And that is just crazy. But we're going to have a stop dead day. And it might actually be that we have to stop selling in November of this year for 2022 delivery for cotton gear, because we won't be able to get the parts or make it in time.
Do you think people are turning more towards the Australian-made products rather than some of the bigger importers just because of the wait time as well?
Yeah, there's some wait time issues. I think there's some transport issues and things like that. I mean, for instance, if you used to buy any parts from China, you used to get shipping out of Shanghai into Brisbane in 10 days. When COVID hit, they changed the shipping routes. It's now 28 days minimum. things like that have happened in all of the supply chain. Anything coming out of America is really slow. So we get motors from America, and we get drive chains, and we get gearboxes from Italy and things like that. And all of that has at least doubled, if not tripled, in time to get it in. That would be great if we had Australian alternatives to those things, but there simply isn't the factory capacity or, you know, the amount of capital that had to be spent to make a factory that made high-end gearboxes or high-end motors just isn't going to happen.
G. Hudson from TTQ Holdings. General Manager of Gyrel Implements, Stuart Kings, says he's seen increased sales and wait times too have risen. So providing a realistic delivering time is vital.
The demand at the moment for our range is very strong on the back of some drought and now coming into good seasons and hopefully backing up. Our current customer base are wanting more product so they can plant their country. In time gone by where we've had a drought, they don't need that because they can't plant their country. Now, because it's been kinder, they're needing to plant more acres or renew their product, therefore the demand for our product is strong.
With this demand that's been increasing, is your supplier able to keep up with this?
We try to. We need to then work with our suppliers, whether it be steel, tyres, hydraulics and also staff, to manage the inquiry base that we get coming in. So it's going to take some managing. We hope to not turn anyone away, but we've got to be able to realistic deliver in time, in full, so the customer's got their product to do their job.
Is there a wait time for your products? Or some of them at least?
Yes, there is. Currently there is because of either our order bank at the moment and then also the supply of raw material.
Is it stopping people from purchasing? Are they going, well, I can't get it here, I'm going to go elsewhere?
Yes, there can be. People will have a time frame they need it, and we've got to be honest and say, well, yes, we can, or no, we can't. And then that's the customer's decision then to buy what they like.
With the asset write-off that people can get on their tax with machinery, has that been an incentive for people to purchase more?
Yes, I believe so. We've definitely seen an increase in demand for that incentive tax write-off, and it's good to see that it's been extended, so that allows us as an Australian manufacturer to facilitate those forward orders that they can write off in this next financial year.
Stuart Kings, the General Manager of Gyrel Implements, ending that report by Anthea Moody out at Farm Fest. It seems all that's left to do is hurry up and wait in that instance. Now, have you ever tasted the Australian native fruit, finger limes, the citrus caviar, if you will? You're going to meet a grower who's successfully exporting them. 9 to 1.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Because it's not easy exporting perishables at the moment, but while many growers are struggling to send, one Queensland farmer has found success with a native fruit. At Peachester, west of Caloundra, Jade King grows finger limes that she's continued to ship despite reduced international flights and closed markets. She's told the ABC's Jennifer Nichols there are still challenges to overcome, but there are opportunities too.
My first market to lose was Italy, and so that was a hard-hitting market for sure because it was my largest. And then it sort of dwindled off from there just with flights and everything to get my product overseas. Definitely became restricted. So I was lucky with Singapore, my agent there, still maintaining shipments to them, and that was really good. And they've supported me all the way through and maintained supply. So definitely a challenging time overall, but yeah, we've managed to keep going and hopefully we'll get our markets back and expand upon those.
How have you had to change your practices to cope with the way you now have to do business?
One thing is we're looking at diversifying our product and doing a frozen variety as well, a frozen packaging style. We've also managed to sort of keep in contact with our current exporters, and hopefully I've got a bit of a lineup of new people that would like us to export once the markets get open. So what we've done is just, I suppose, put things on hold a little bit, but plan for the future to expand that way.
And you're based in the most beautiful area at Peachester near the Glasshouse Mountains, where you literally are in a very green valley where you've built your farm. How many trees do you now have in your orchards?
We've got 1,200 of the champagne red, and then another 400 chartreuse and then 200 emeralds. So we're sort of expanding on that, and there's more to go in.
And for anybody who hasn't had the opportunity to try a finger lime, the cells inside are circular, so they really pop in your mouth. They're almost like a citrus caviar.
Yeah, definitely. And the key thing is it's not just a visual sensation, it's a taste sensation. So it's a bit of both, and that bursting flavour of the pearls once you break them in your mouth, it's amazing.
Now, I understand the Queensland government actually came to assist you with a diversification and resilience grant, allowing you to buy a blast chiller and freezer room. How are you using that?
Yeah, so the idea is that's the diversification of our product in freezing product, whether it be whole fruit or as pearls packaged. So we're looking at both of those things. It definitely helps when it comes to export as well, because some markets for the future will only take frozen products. So that's definitely something we're looking at.
So that's Japan and the United States only accept frozen product?
Yeah, so it will hopefully help us enter and maintain those markets.
So have you got that up and running already, Jade King, or is it still in the process?
Oh, it's still in the process. We've sort of done a few trials to work out the best way about freezing the product, and there's a few other things going on, and it's very busy. Haven't really had a lot of time to really take that on and expand that. And until the markets pick up a little bit in the export area, then, yeah, we won't sort of be able to fully go down that line. So it's just trial at the moment.
They're a very prickly bush to deal with. Are you still enjoying it, Jade King?
Well, you can ask me today and then I'll say yes. Some days, no. But no, I love what I do and I'm blessed to be able to have all of what I've got. So, yeah, I do still love what I do and I love growing the fact that it's an Australian native. It's something unique. It's a pretty amazing product. So, yeah, I definitely still enjoy what I do.
That's Jade King from Green Valley Finger Limes at Peachester. She also won the New Exporter Award at the Queensland Horticulture Export Awards, speaking there with the Sunny Coast's Jennifer Nichols. Well, after the success of Beef Australia 2021, the city of Rockhampton has backed up for its annual show. And again, there's always a strong focus on beef cattle, but at this event, it was the school kids who really shone. Our reporter Ashley Bagshaw hit the showgrounds, and what could possibly go wrong with cattle and children?
What do you think made your animals winners?
Just the judge.
That's Cody Mortimer, a student from the Cathedral College in Rockhampton. The annual show's stud cattle event saw fierce competition between the juniors, with a number of schools represented, including TCC, where Cody's classmates Dawson Jones and Chloe Davey gave me an insight into their extensive preparation.
Oh, we've been keeping them clean, brushing them down, you know, just stuff to make them look better in the show ring.
And so how long have you been preparing for?
Cattle have been in here for a couple of days, but before a show you always got to prepare a couple of weeks before to get everything right.
And so how have you done today?
Oh, I've done all right. I got fifth in junior judging.
So what makes a good steer?
A good steer, you want nice, good fat coverage. Good length about them, good depth, one nice spring of ribs, anything that makes that steer a bit bigger on the day.
So you guys have been preparing together, have you?
Yeah, Dawson and I have, yeah, we go out every Tuesday and Thursday to, you know, break the animals in. So when it comes to show time, they're, you know, quiet and, yeah, ready to show off, yeah.
Some made their debut in centre ring, but others were long-time campaigners. Either way, it was clear the students revelled in the learning experience. Rockhampton Girls Grammar students Macy McGilvray and Jessica Chapman had 5 head of cattle to take care of.
We wash them and brush them and lead them and like practice using the cane on them and just like get them calm and used to us, and then we start leading them.
How long have you been working with them?
Since the start of the year.
And so what makes a good animal in the ring?
When they're clean and they've got good muscle coverage and they're long.
So what have you done to help with the preparation?
I've helped brushing and mucking at the beds and feeding them, getting up early and helping.
I bet there's been a lot of early starts.
Yeah, it's been pretty tiring, pretty ready for bed now.
but was it all worth it for today?
Yeah, it was a really good day. It was really fun. Good for the girls to get out there because lots of girls are new, so it's good for them to get out of their comfort zones.
Was there a lot who it's coming along to their first show today?
Yeah, like half the team is new this year, so it's been really good.
Wow. And so have you guys had a lot of success as a new team?
I think one of our steers got second in his class and our little heifer got first this morning. And then I got first in judging. Macy got third. And then lots of other girls have got ribbons too.
Do you think the girls are doing it better than the boys?
Yes. We obviously would beat them.
Love that resolute answer. That's students from the Rockhampton Girls Grammar School lending that report from Ashley Bagshaw. You'd agree the future of the cattle comp at the Rocky Show certainly looking very good. Briefly, some beef news. According to Meat and Livestock Australia, there's been a shift this year with more than 50% of beef consumed by Aussies in the first quarter coming from feedlots. All in line with the ECI, the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator, reaching a new high, hitting 913.22 cents per kilograms yesterday, up some 200 cents on last year. Amy Phillips will be back in the saddle on Monday. Have a safe and happy weekend. News time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.